Mark Garrett. Welcome to Truth Nation. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Bill, how are you, sir?
I'm doing okay. Mark, when is the last time you used AI for something? Do you use it at all? Like,
you know what? I use it just by accident. You put anything in Google, and the first thing it brings up, it's an AI answer.
Yeah. But have you found issues with accuracy?
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
Yes.
You know, I used it when we did, you and I did on your Leo Nation, a show about the California fires, and I was asking very specific questions. Mm-hmm. And I would get the answer, and I would even follow up with a very specific point, and it would give me a very specific answer, and that turned out to be inaccurate in one case. I later found out that it wasn't an inaccurate answer. So,
by the way, just two things here, Bill. Yeah, inaccurate, but I think in a more like 30,000 foot level kind of thing is lack of objectivity. With it, but inaccuracy under that umbrella. Yes. Yeah.
You bring up a good point because we're going to get into that today. It depends on what the AI is trained on, right? Mm-hmm. It's only as good as its training, just like a human being.
Yep.
Mark, in November of 24 in San Francisco, a gentleman named Sucheer Balaji was found dead in his apartment. And since that time, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding his death, especially if you look at X and some of the social media platforms. A lot of controversy regarding how he died. And we are going to take that on today. Mark, what I am going to try to do with your help is talk about all the reasons why it was not a murder, and all the reasons why it should be investigated as a murder, and basically put all those facts out there and then ask our listeners to comment and weigh in on what they think happened to this young man. I've seen on social media a definite slant towards murder. Again, I said he was found dead in his apartment. There is definite slant towards cover up, towards murder, towards a bit of a conspiracy theory, which we'll get into. But it's one thing to just say that, like, hey, this is what I think happened. But to some extent, you have to look at evidence and facts. And that's what we're going to try to do here in the next hour or so. Provide people with information, encourage them to make up their mind, and then see what our listeners have to say about it, what they think happened and what the next steps should be. So I think first, Mark, we'll talk a little bit about who Sucheer was, then what he did, where he worked, why he left that particular company. We'll talk about his death, the crime scene, and a lawsuit that he was involved in, which I think is key to a lot of the conspiracy theories surrounding his death. So first, who was he? He was 26 years old. He was maybe a bit of a computer programming prodigy. He had a degree in computer science from UC Berkeley. And I think there was a time, Mark, where he actually went to his parents and said, I don't need a college degree. And either he dropped out or he didn't go to college immediately after high school or something, and took a year, worked, got a job as a programmer, got a nice $25,000 signing bonus to work in programming, and then at some point decided to go back to school or to go to UC Berkeley and get his degree, which he did.
Anything by the way, about Bill, his,
go ahead.
Not unusual for these prodigies. We can talk about any number of people who are billionaires now had a similar path.
Yeah, right. That is interesting. And I don't know, maybe there's a move in this country in general, people questioning the investment in college when you're ending up with a couple hundred thousand in debt, and really, you know, is that the avenue that it used to be towards success? And it may not be. I don't know. So, Mark, the job that he had, right? So here's this young man, computer programming prodigy, at least according to his mom, who's been very outspoken about this case. And of course, there's a reason for that. The coroner ruled the injuries that resulted in his death as self-inflicted, trying not to use that one word, you know? Mm-hmm. Yep. So the coroner ruled it as a self-inflicted injury-related death. And she feels that this is most definitely not the case, that there's abundant evidence that a homicide was committed and that the police didn't do a thorough job in investigating it. Mark, I think important to talk about now where some of that fuel comes from, because he worked for OpenAI, the company OpenAI. And at the time when he started working there, I believe it was called, and Anthony or Vince will correct me, I believe it was called Web GPT. It wasn't yet Chat GPT. They were developing this AI model called Web GPT. And, you know, he supposedly, according to his mom, was a key contributor in the project. And this is what I found independently about that, Mark. I'll read this little bit here. Sucheer Balaji played a significant role in the development of Chat GPT. He was a key contributor to the project, particularly in the early stages with the Web GPT project, which helped pave the way for Chat GPT. His attention to detail and ability to find simple, elegant solutions were highly valued by his colleagues. It almost sounds like a line from a resume or something, doesn't it?
It does. It's almost a cut and paste.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And I don't know where that statement came from, if it was something released by the company after the death, or if it was something from his, like I said, his resume or somewhere where he kept like a curriculum vitae or something of work that he'd done. However, Balaji later shifted to organizing the large data sets used to train GPT-4 and raised ethical and legal concerns about the use of copyrighted material in training AI models. His contributions were essential, and he was considered one of OpenAI's strongest contributors. So that's a pretty strong testament to what he did at OpenAI, correct? I mean, that sounds like a relatively large role. I mean, I don't know, Mark, if there's thousands of programmers that were involved in this, it doesn't sound like it.
But that's the question, and right. I have the same question. It's certainly significant, you know, in his role. But one of the questions is you just said it. Is he one of thousands, or was he one of a few dozen? That does shed a little bit of different light on it. But either way, it's a very, very significant role that he played.
And I mentioned there his ethical and legal concerns about the use of copyrighted materials. And really, I think that's a crucial piece to this whole puzzle. And that's not, you know, what I think people need to understand about that is that's really not something that's been in the shadows. Like, that's something that's been pretty openly talked about. There are several lawsuits over it that we'll get into. It's not like this secret thing that was happening. It was all a question of, should there be regulation? Should there be rules against this? You know, is this harming business to operate AI in this manner? And I guess what an example of this might be, you know, when you or I are doing research on something and we're using some kind of AI model, it's scouring its database of copyrighted materials, and it's producing an answer from that material, and I guess the way to look at it is no revenue is going to the creator of the content.
Right.
Right. Like for me, I pay for a subscription to the LA Times, but I could go to OpenAI or some AI model, ask a question about a recent article and get a description of it or a summary of it without having that subscription to the LA Times. So the question is that ethical, and is that how these models should be fueled going forward? Because without the training, without this data going into the system, it's really worthless. Like it's only worth, or the value of it comes from the data that goes in. Mm-hmm. So one thing that he did, and he being Sucheer, is he published an article or a letter that's still available on the internet. And it talks about a statistical downturn to knowledge communities. What are knowledge communities? This is not an example that he used, but this is one that I know, so I'll use it. Like, let's say, Mark, you're having some kind of trouble with your car and you decide to go on Reddit and look for a community of people that own that truck and ask a specific question, right? And say, hey, has anyone had this issue with this model car, with this engine? What he said was, as ChatGPT came online, access and traffic to all these knowledge communities diminished, and he could actually track this. And the premise was, or what he was saying was going on, is there's no longer a reason to go and talk to individual human experts who are on these, quote, bulletin boards or in these knowledge communities. You don't have to do that anymore. Now, artificial intelligence models are collecting all that information that's out there in those knowledge communities, and you can just ask AI a question, and it will produce the answer from those communities. So all these for-profit communities were, I guess, ostensibly suffering because AI is taking their information and putting it out there as if it's their own information. And as ChatGPT kind of went on, I think Sucheer's job, as I mentioned already, was, and this is a quote from his mom, scooping up all the internet data and feeding to ChatGPT AI model. Like, that was his responsibility, was collecting all this information and getting it into the system. What do you think of that, Mark, just in ethical terms, when we see people, you know, he's kind of statistically corroborating his contention that this is harming business, this use of copyrighted material, or maybe not even copyrighted, but this use of kind of monetized or owned content, grabbing it and putting it out as if it's their own, and then people are not going to these knowledge communities anymore.
Yeah. Intellectual property. Yeah. It, it's a fascinating subject. I mean, onto itself, you know, aside from, you know, this tragic event, whatever it was, how it happened, because when you think about AI, what you're talking about, Bill, in other words, it makes sense that the AI doesn't create information. It only gathers it, and then it gives it back to you as requested. And so where does it come from? And it's not something until very recently I even had even thought about. But in other words, about how this works, about how the input process works. So it makes total sense. The question is whether they're obtaining this information, you know, within the law, within civil law. If you're taking someone else's work and now you're compiling it and you're using it to generate these AI responses, it's a fascinating topic. Obviously, these lawsuits are not brand new. They're not exclusive to OpenAI / ChatGPT, but they're most prominent. So to your earlier point, these questions of legality and how AI actually works, how it's generated, it lays this foundation to ask questions about, you know, how this gentleman came to his demise, because it is very intriguing and it can have huge, huge financial impact on these companies.
Right. And he quit the company in August of 24. So what is that, about six months ago now, Mark? Yep.
Oh, yeah. Ago. Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Did you see anything that would indicate that he quit for any reason other than his kind of legal or ethical concerns?
Not that I could, you know, I read a few articles, one from the parents' point of view. I read another news article about the lawsuits. And so I didn't see anything that popped out to me other than, you know, his whistleblower status and you know, wanting to separate, you know, from the company. I didn't see anything other than that.
Yeah, right. So what was going on at the company at that time? If you turn back the clock and look at about 9 months before he left, so now we're back to December of 2023. Here's an article from CNN that was online December 27, 2023. The New York Times has sued OpenAI and Microsoft. I guess Microsoft has a Copilot AI model, it's called. I think it's called Copilot.
Yeah.
For copyright infringement, alleging that the company's artificial intelligence technology illegally copied millions of Times articles to train ChatGPT and other services to provide people with instant access to information, technology that now competes with the New York Times. Interesting, right? So what what's that?
Millions of articles.
Millions of articles. So they, I don't want to say steal. That's probably not the right term, although maybe maybe that's what this lawsuit is about. But
they obtained
millions of articles, and now all of a sudden they're competing with the New York Times using the New York Times' own information. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the essence of what this lawsuit was about. And I bring up this lawsuit because Sucheer did get involved with this lawsuit, and I think it's important to talk about his connection. So again, I said that he died in November of 2024. Mm-hmm. I think he died on the 22nd, and his body was found on the 26th of November, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I think it was. It was 22nd and 23rd he died. Okay. Maybe it's 22nd.
And the interesting thing here is, and I think I have this date correct, Mark, from all I could find, the New York Times named him as a custodial witness in this lawsuit on November 18th. So just 4 days before his death. Mm-hmm. And important to talk about what that means, because there's been a lot of speculation, a lot of conspiracy theories out there that that perhaps OpenAI was trying to silence him, that he had information that was going to disrupt their business, and he was going to provide it, you know, at trial or in deposition or whatever. But to talk about what it means to be a custodial witness, and when you're identified as a custodial witness, the lawyers in this case for the New York Times, for them to designate him a custodial witness, it means they already have the information that he had.
Right.
They would not name custodial witness means he's the custodian or the holder or owner of certain documents. So he is the custodial witness. He has some documents from OpenAI, and they name him as a custodial witness, meaning now at deposition, he is going to lay the foundation to have those documents, which the lawyers already have. He's going to lay the foundation to have those documents admitted as evidence at deposition. The lawyers would not name him as a custodial witness, Mark, if they had no idea what the information he had was. They're going to look at the end. Now, who contacted who knows? But they are going to review the documents. They're going to make an assessment if they help the case, if they're beneficial to their case. And if the answer is yes, they're going to name him as a custodial witness. And when he is deposed, he is going to be used to get those documents into evidence. Whistleblower, right? This whole, his status as a whistleblower, I guess technically he is a corporate whistleblower because he was raising concerns about morality and ethics in the use of this copyrighted information. I don't know, Mark, if you've seen or had experience with whistleblowers while working in California state government.
Oh, yes.
I have. And my experience was because listen, a theory could be, right? A theory how this could be a murder was, okay, Bill and Mark, I get it. The lawyers already have this information that they're going to use in the lawsuit. They name him as a custodial witness. So it doesn't really do any good to kill him after he's already provided this information. But maybe he has more information. Maybe he has more information that he was holding back and hadn't provided it yet. And that is why they, you know, being this nefarious person or someone hypothetically associated with OpenAI, that's why he was killed and his apartment was, quote, ransacked, which we'll get into. Here's my experience with whistleblowers, Mark. They dump everything. They dump everything up front. If they have information, it's usually an emotional decision and a hard decision to kind of blow the whistle on, you know, your place where you're currently working, your place where you used to work. So my opinion would be that he probably provided at least up front everything that he had to these lawyers in an effort to get his point across or kind of you know, facilitate whatever action he thought was appropriate. Was your experience different in that, that maybe you've encountered whistleblowers who kind of piecemeal stuff out, or they'll give a little bit of information and then a little more and a little more?
No, not at all, Bill. Very much consistent with what you laid it out. One of the things to consider when it comes to whistleblowers is, not always, but often they may not be in a supervisory or managerial roles. They are a lower level in, you know, say, well, say first line employee. So their perspective, understandably, is very narrow about, you know, day-to-day operations. They may not have a larger overview. Again, that's not 100% true. Often managers are the whistleblowers. But my point is this, is that when they do come forward, the information they have, their allegations, to put it that way, are very, very narrow, and they're very, very concentrated on a particular topic. And like you said, everything in regard to that concern is vomited. Everything mm-hmm. comes out. So it's not like it comes out piecemeal. There'd be no reason from their point of view to do that. And quite frankly, there wouldn't be any reason for a lawyer representing them to have them do that either. They want to get as much information as they can. Now, by the way, lawyers might decide to release things over a certain period of time, but they're going to have things up. They're going to have things very, very early on, I think, you know, pretty much completely. So I agree with the way you laid it out.
So my point in bringing this up is, this murder, if it was a murder, right, it would not have made sense that he was murdered to stop him from turning over documents. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yes.
Whatever documents he was custodial witness for were already turned over. The lawyers already have them. And more than likely, Mark, the defense, OpenAI, already has them too. Because through discovery, right, the process by which the plaintiff has to provide information to the defendant in the case, all these documents would have been turned over. And that's probably, that was done at the time he was named as the custodial witness.
I agree.
Now, so there's a point where I say, no, if that's people's motivation for thinking this was a murder, that's not a valid motivation. But here's something I've also seen, Mark, to flip the coin now. And I'm curious if you've observed this. Someone from a company who's left, or even if they're still inside, they become a whistleblower. And I think our friend Pete Fraselli, the former deputy director of ATF or assistant deputy director of ATF, who was involved in whistleblowing on the Fast and Furious operation in the Obama years, I think he spoke of this. Once you've been identified, so Suchir, very publicly now, at this time, so we're talking last fall, November of 24, has become a whistleblower. He's brought up these concerns. So other people in the company who maybe were not as bold as he was, but maybe they agree with him and they say, wow, he actually has the guts to go out and say something about this. I'm going to contact him because I have more information. And now people within the company start using Suchir as a conduit to pass more, quote, whistleblower information about other things going on at the company. Have you seen that at all in your work in state government, where there's people that are still on the inside that maybe didn't have the courage to come out and be the front person, but they start reaching out to these whistleblowers and kind of egging them on and supplying them with more information?
You know, Bill, it's a great question. And I don't remember specifically that scenario in an official sense. I certainly remember that in a scuttlebutt sense where, mm-hmm. Yes, you know, so-and-so's coming forward, or, you know, someone's talking about this policy or this practice and they're right. And in other words, people are just talking even in public about, yeah, I saw that too, or whatever. But I don't remember that in a specific sense. Now, the fact that I don't remember it doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. I'm talking about, you know, my narrow, perspective on this with the handful of cases that I remember. That certainly could happen. And it's certainly a logical assumption to make that he could have been a mouthpiece for other people who are afraid to become public or go public. So what you're saying makes sense. It's definitely a possibility. Whether that happened or not, we certainly don't know at this point.
Yep. So that's something, you know, that's something that would have to be discerned from maybe looking through his emails, looking at his communication devices. Was he in contact with people that were still at the company? And then law enforcement reaching out to those people at the company and speaking with them about their contact with them. So that's potential, right? That's potential, something that should be followed up on, that could be a motive, I guess. But here's an interesting thing, Mark. Although I said the lawyer has the documents, right? So if this was a murder, the murder would not have been committed to stop the lawyers from getting the documents, because he would have already provided them, to make that clear. Who now lays the foundation,
right,
to get those evidence into court? That's 100%. The challenge now, right? The lawyers had planned that he was going to be this custodial witness. He was going to lay the foundation and bring validity to those documents. He could kind of validate them and say, yes, this is an email that I received on my work email account that talked about whatever it talked about, copyrighted material or how to do this or how to do that. He would be the one that would lay the foundation to admit that stuff into evidence. Without him, you know, my question mark is, which I know neither of us can really answer, is what happens?
Yeah, what happens?
Yeah.
We're not lawyers. And, you know, I would imagine, Bill, and again, we have some attorney friends out there listening to us. Please, please comment and you set us straight here. I would imagine that certain documents probably stand on their own without a foundation, some. And we can't forget the fact that if you're talking about emails, in other words, there's got to be two people on an email. So it doesn't mean that other people can't be subpoenaed to come testify, things like that, to lay a foundation. Did you receive this email? Did you send this email? So he, again, from my non-legal trained perspective, my guess is that there are other ways to at least get some of this admitted as evidence in a proceeding. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. Like, I don't really see his death as something that would completely prevent any of those documents from getting in, especially if they're emails. Because like you said, there's always going to be someone else that could be subpoenaed, deposed, and asked if they were the person who sent that email, right?
Yes.
So there is always another way to do it. So not a very strong motive to say that this was a murder, because I don't think his murder will prevent, in my opinion, right, handling a lot of criminal cases with evidence, you know, watching how evidence is introduced. I don't think him being, quote, unavailable will really hamper getting those documents in. They just have to find a different route. It could take a little longer, etc. The other thing to note here, Mark, is when that designation of custodial witness was made public by the New York Times, and that was on November 18th, the best I can tell. Mm-hmm. And he was on vacation at that time. He was on vacation at Catalina Island from November 16th to 22nd. Catalina Island, a small island off the coast of Long Beach, California?
Long Beach, San Pedro, 26 miles across the sea, as the song goes, yes.
Right. It's not like you're completely disconnected from civilization when you're out there, right? It's you still get email, you still have cell phone service. So although, you know, part of me wonders how connected he was while he was on vacation, and did he know this happened, or was it a shock that he found out when he returned on the 22nd? That would perhaps have influence on whether I would think this was self-inflicted, right? If he didn't know that he was publicly named, and then he gets back from vacation and finds out that he's publicly named, and likely there would be people reaching out to him telling him, what, Mark, career suicide? I mean, if you're talking about a startup company in AI, or if you want to work in the AI field, like, what's your opinion on that? Do you think you're going to bring someone in who has been a whistleblower and had these ethical and moral concerns about how AI is trained? Is that career suicide to do something like this?
Well, it's a very fair question, isn't it? And quite possibly, the time frame you're talking about when he's in Catalina Island for a few days around his birthday, mm-hmm. And is he disconnected from the web, so to speak, and from the rest of the world? The answer is no. I've been to Catalina a million times with the cell phone, both work and personal, and unfortunately, no, you don't disconnect. But of course, he's with friends, he's with crowds, he's in public. So is he going to or able to commit some type of an act that's alleged by the authorities in public, or is he in so much of a state of shock? Is he so emotionally distraught that within a couple of days getting back home that he engages this behavior? That's quite possible. He wouldn't do it on the boat going across, from Catalina back to San Pedro or Long Beach. So the timing is very interesting, to say the least. And would that be a shock to the system? Quite likely. Likely, when you read this article about you in one of the world's most well-known publications, there's a lot of pressure one way or another or both.
And I think, my idea in bringing this little part up here, Mark, was that as any parent would, right? I want to make that clear. And I feel for his mm-hmm. mom. She's been very out front on this and done a lot of speaking on this. Her position is there is absolutely no reason or no indication that he would have done anything to inflict self-harm, right? According to her, he was in great spirits. Everything was great. But this is a pretty major thing. This is a pretty major thing in one's professional life to be identified as someone who is a whistleblower, against the number, arguably, really the number one company in his chosen field, especially at a time with Stargate, and we're hearing about a $500 billion investment in AI, and it's going to be an exploding industry now. These are all things since, we kicked off 2025 here, so that wouldn't have been known last November, but still an exploding industry. And, are you now persona non grata in that industry because of what you did? And I think that's a major point that that perhaps the family is overlooking when talking about why he would choose, if he did so, to choose self-harm.
Right? Bill, you talk about Stargate and this huge investment that went from $100 billion now to $500 billion, and these are all subsequent to the end of Shakir's life. But being in that industry, he may have heard rumblings about this coming, in other words. So he may have known more than we even do now about the potential for growth, for investment. And so it may have been more impactful, this information about him, being out as a whistleblower than even we can appreciate right now. He probably had a really good handle on how fast things were growing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I that's an important piece, I think, that people should consider when forming their opinion on how he ended up dying is look at that piece there of when he was identified. And this was his first night back, after vacation. So let's talk about that, Mark. Let's talk about kind of where he lived and how that notification happened, the interaction between law enforcement and the parents. And I'm going to lean on you a bit when we get to it, because I know that you have done several death notifications, unfortunately, and I'm sure they're never easy. I'm sure it's not something that you look forward to doing, but I think it's important to hear from you about the protocol involved, because when I first saw the interaction with law enforcement, I thought, man, that's very weak on the part of law enforcement and very strange how they handled it. But, I think after speaking to you a little bit about it offline, I kind of realized, like, well, there is protocols and you have to do things in a certain order at a certain time. So let me run through a little bit what happened. So he returned from vacation on the 22nd. And after that evening of the 22nd, his parents didn't hear from him for a couple of days, which I guess was a little unusual. They tried to call him, and his mom made a point of saying that, his phone rang once and then it went to voicemail. she made the decision to actually go to his apartment. So I'm not sure where she lived.
Yeah.
But she actually traveled to San Francisco and filed, I guess, a missing persons report, which had to be done, and went to his apartment. Now, it's a rather large complex, right? Four or five large apartment buildings. And I guess she went back and forth with police a bit about they couldn't do anything unless there was a missing persons report filed. And then she eventually filed one and et cetera, et cetera. But I know that on the 26th, she got to the apartment at 1 p.m. And she had called the police to meet her there. They arrived there at 1:09 p.m. And she says she was not told anything until about 4 p.m. that afternoon, that she had to wait outside. Now, the police got there at 1:09. They went in, and she said that she has seen, when I say she, the mom, I think she had reviewed some report that the police had written that at 1:13 p.m., so about 4 minutes after they had arrived, they had actually gone inside the apartment and saw the body. And they came out in 5 to 10 minutes. And at that time, they told the mom they could not go in again until two more officers came. Mark, can you talk about why at that time they would not potentially, or why they probably possibly didn't tell her what they had found in the apartment? And you know, that her son was dead inside the apartment.
Well, there could be a number of things. The first thing comes to mind, you know, from my experience, Bill, is positive identification.
Right.
That's the first thing. And by the way, and not just with the party in the apartment, the victim there, the deceased, but also you're not going to divulge the status of the victim in there to just anybody. So the next of kin would be somebody that you would be authorized to, again, in my experience, you know, you make that death notification to the next of kin. So first, you have to get a positive identification. Now, you know, there are 58 counties in California. So 58 either coroners or medical examiners. And so you have varying protocol. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles County, in my experience, where I spent 30 years, the authority of identification is the coroner.
Right.
So when the coroner arrives on scene, we have to wait until, you know, he or she, that representative of the coroner's office, has agreed to the identification of the party or parties involved. By the way, often that doesn't happen. You don't have ID, they're burn victims, there are all kinds of reasons you can't make an immediate identification. But when it's available, that's made by the coroner. So that you and the coroner agree, yes, this person is John Doe, you know, so to speak. And now you just have a powwow there. Hey, are you going to make the death notification, coroner or officer? Are you going to make the death notification? And 9 times out of 10, guess who, you know, we agreed to do. Mm-hmm. It would be me. And so that's the first step there. The other thing is, too, is even if you know that, okay, this person is so-and-so here, and this person is the next of kin, a good investigator may drag their feet on purpose because you're not sure what happened in there. By the way, is this person involved? I doubt it. You know, it's, right. It appears to be the mom, appears to be the dad. You have to think about these things ahead of time. I'm not going to tell them who they are, what we found, things like that. So there are various varying processes and protocols, and then it really comes down often to your relationship with the coroner, the medical examiner, and your chain of command, what the inside SOP is when it comes to death notification. Now, you alluded to the one officer saying, hey, we have to wait till two more officers get here. I imagine those are the detectives.
That was going to be my next question to you, Mark. In my mind, those would be the detectives, homicide detectives who are on call in, you know, police departments like San Francisco. They get the phone call. There's a body. They got to come out and do an assessment. So yeah, you want to fill in anything on that? Because I thought the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you're going to have your first, you know, welfare check call. Hey, whatever. You have the uniform show up. Okay, we have a scene here. We have a death here, and right. Then they're going to make the notification. Their chain of command, whatever. They're going to call, a robbery homicide, and they're going to roll out with their detectives, the experts in this, and those guys are going to make the determination to the best of their ability. Those guys or gals about what the manner of death was. In other words, homicide, suicide, accidental, things like that. That's going to be their preliminary job in conjunction with the medical examiner. And really it comes down to the detectives in this, and something like this is about, making, a notification or assigning someone to make a notification. So those officers are just going to say, hey, we can't tell anything right now. We're waiting for a higher authority to show up.
Yep. And that's exactly what I thought. So, I said, just to recap a bit, at 1:13, the police saw the body inside, came back out in 5 to 10 minutes, and they told the mom they couldn't go back in until two more officers came. Now, this happened at 2 p.m. So at 2 p.m., the two additional officers showed up, who I am speculating, along with you, that they were homicide investigators or at least detectives. And they went back in. Now, they told her at that time that she should go back home and they would call her in maybe 5 to 6 hours. They told her that they were waiting now for two more officers. And then at 3:20, a coroner van showed up and mom knew something was up at that point. And the mom said that she at 4 p.m., she found out that there was a dead person in the apartment. And that's where she arrived at her statement that in 40 minutes, they determined it was a suicide, because the coroner arrived at 3:20 and I guess told her at 4 p.m., 40 minutes later, that there was a dead person inside. And she said that she was waiting in the leasing office and the coroner came or medical examiner came to the leasing office and said that Suchir had, it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound or injury that killed him. So is that kind of substantiates, although someone hearing about that might say, man, that's weird. Why wouldn't they tell her right away? I don't know, Mark, I feel like you've done a good job of talking about the role of the first responding police officers, welfare check, the role of the detectives who now have been called out because it's a crime scene and there is a body. And then the next step, the role of the coroner, who is actually the one in your experience that does the actual identification that says, yes, this is who this is, right? That kind of goes in line with how a normal notification would be handled, or am I off base on that?
No, that sounds all, consistent with my experience, even though we're talking about different counties. One thing, Bill, a couple of the articles I think are at best erroneous, because the way they're written, it sounds like that law enforcement had made a determination within 40 minutes that this was a suicide. And it's not really accurate. In other words, it was hours before that determination was made, at least preliminary determination. And, based on what you just said.
Yeah, correct. So let's look at some other things here. He had a gun that belonged to him and, that was on the table, and there was the kind of receipt for the gun that was with it, what's called in California a DROS form right there. You can see it. Dealer's record of sale, I think that stands for DROS, and it's, describes the gun, the serial number. You can see the 9mm cartridges. And is it unusual for that receipt to be in the gun case like that? Not really in California. It's not, Mark, because
it's excellent point, Bill.
Right.
Man, you got right into my head, especially California. Yeah, this is mine. I got it legally. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, I have guns in cases where I've actually laminated that form and I have it in the, like a rifle, for example, and I have it in the case and it goes everywhere the gun goes, just in case there's ever a question about the legality of purchase or what the gun is or who the owner is, I can have that laminated form handy to pull out. So I don't think that's uncommon at all. I don't know. What do you think, Mark? There was a lot made about, there was only video at one apartment entrance, and there was no video at the other two. And there's some discussion that, well, there's no way to know then who came or went. Well, even if there's video at the, even if there's video recording at the main entrance to an apartment, you know, how do you know who's going to visit? It's four or five buildings. How do you know who's going to visit his specific apartment?
Right.
You know, it does give you a group of people to perhaps try to focus on that came, you know, sometime in the hours after he arrived back from his trip until later that evening. But it's really doesn't do too much to pinpoint anyone coming or going, whether there's video or not. Right.
I agree.
How about we look at the crime scene here, because we have some pictures. And, you know, the mom's contention is that only evidence indicative of a suicide was collected and other evidence was left behind. And I don't know, we can start with and also there was a contention that the apartment was ransacked. And one thing to say about that, I don't, we could start at the bottom or start at the top here. It doesn't matter. But look at them all. I mean. Here's the other thing I want to point out, that this is his first day back after being away on vacation. I want to just talk about the contention that the apartment is ransacked. And again, my goal in bringing up a lot of these points is to provide alternate explanations and let people make their own decision, right? I'm not saying this was a murder, wasn't a murder. I'm putting the evidence out there, and I'll say what my conclusion is, but that doesn't mean everyone should agree with me. But he flew from San Francisco to LA and then, you know, took the boat out to Catalina Island. When you're packing for a trip and you're 26 years old, or even if you're 40, 56 years old, I don't know how it goes in your household, Mark. If you're waking up in the morning and packing for a trip quickly because you're running late, what does your bedroom or house look like when you're going out the door?
Well, maybe not quite ass as shoveled as that, but disorderly. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you this. When my now wife and I first started dating, her first visit to my apartment, she thought it was a crime scene too. Mm-hmm. So and you know, it not to make too much light of it, but you know, one person's ransacked apartment is another person's, oh, it's Tuesday morning.
Yep.
So it really, the thing is, if we had a baseline, if we had a series of photos from a month and a year earlier in this apartment compared to what we're seeing now, I think we could make a better judgment about the would-be discrepancy between then and now, or the day of you know, the incident. But to look at it just static like this without any comparison to his daily lifestyle or general lifestyle and cleanliness or lack thereof, it's very difficult to make a judgment about, is this out of order? It may be out of order for any number of people listening to this podcast and watching the podcast today. It may not be out of order for him.
Yeah, it you know, I could argue, Mark, that this looks like a bachelor pad, a 26-year-old bachelor pad.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's a little messier than I kept my apartment, yeah, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and as we're looking at the pictures here, you know, I see cleaning supplies around, right? I see spray cleaner on the counter. I see a mop. I see a vacuum. How about the photo of the desk? Can we bring that up right here? So let's talk about some of the things in this picture. A meal that he had apparently just eaten, right? Now, that's interesting, I think. A bottle of ibuprofen right above that blue label there, you know, brand name or generic kind of like Advil. Over to the left, there's going to be a sleep aid, some kind of what looks like a natural sleep aid.
By the way, it looks really familiar because you can find that in my house too.
Yep. And then, zinc lozenges there for, you know, I don't know, generally immunity support or general health support. I don't know. Is that indicative of anything? Trouble sleeping, trouble with pain, a glass of water next to the ibuprofen? Mm-hmm. You know, who can say? I don't really see anything crazy there out of the ordinary. I do agree that it's, you know, he just ate a meal and then he's dead just a couple hours later. I think what he did on the computer in that time is probably very important. And we don't know too much about that, to be honest. We know that his browsing history, there was traffic up to 10 o'clock at night, but we don't really know exactly what he was doing on there. Anything else in these pictures, guys? Let's see. There's the desk. So let's talk about this. You know, one thing, Mark, that I don't know, and I really looked and could not find it. Do you know where his body was found, or even Anthony or Vince, do you know where his body was found in the apartment?
Yes.
Okay.
So in the article, the most recent one that I read, his body was found with the head, and you keep scrolling, keep going right there.
Okay.
So that area there, and we haven't been able to determine, I haven't, what that red item is there. I'm not sure if it's a hat or if it's a piece of clothing, but anyway, there in the door jamb is where, based on the description from the article I read, is where his head was laying and where the blood pooled, and his feet were facing away from the bathroom. It's a bathroom door right there. So that's what I read in the most recent article that I read this morning, actually.
Okay. And if anyone can identify what that red piece of cloth is here in this video, or I'm calling it cloth, I don't know what it is. Let us know. Drop in the comments. And you see an earbud there, right? Mm-hmm. Right there is an earbud. This is the threshold of the bathroom. There's more blood by the sink straight ahead there. Mark, talk to me about that blood spatter. Like, I know enough about blood spatter that I can say that those drops look like they fell more or less straight down. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, because there is no slant. There's no directional aspect to them whatsoever that I can see from here.
Right.
And by the way, I'm not a crime scene expert. 95% of all of my training experience comes from traffic accidents, but physics are all the same. And so I dealt with a lot of blood spatter, but usually not in a crime scene capacity. But it's all the same when it comes to physics and science.
And one thing that... one thing that I heard was that, okay, so talking about the injury, he did have a blunt force trauma injury to the back of his head. And according to the mom, the gunshot did not actually hit his brain. Mm-hmm. So it's quite possible, Mark, that however this injury happened, he was alive for a few moments after the shot. Is that a fair thing to say when you see a scene like this?
100%.
And if you hear that, if you see a scene like this and you hear that the bullet didn't actually strike his brain, mm-hmm. my immediate thought would be that he lived a bit after it, and that maybe he just died from blood loss, actually, relatively quickly, but it was blood loss.
Yeah, I would agree. I think before we went on air, I was actually recalling an incident. This is, I don't know, it must be close to 20 years ago, where a suspect actually, out of a hand-to-hand combat with one of the CHP officers, obtained the CHP officer's weapon, and later on committed suicide. But I won't get into all the details, but it's actually caught on video, the entire incident after this person fled the scene with the CHP weapon, and actually shot himself in the head, but did not die instantly. He was actually still sitting up with his gunshot wound, mm-hmm. and eventually, and very slowly, keeled over. I'm talking probably a good minute or so, and finally fell over, and was clearly still alive, and then and died. So the idea that if a bullet, if the mother is correct, and if this bullet did not hit the brain, is it possible someone, like you said, Bill, lives a short time afterwards? I would think it's very possible.
Yeah, and you know, another point that was made was that the bullet entered at a 30 to 45 degree downward angle from the top. And, you know, probably not the most common for a self-inflicted gunshot wound, Mark, right?
Yeah.
I think most often it's from the bottom, or I'm trying not to say it in a manner that's going to, you know, avail us to censorship here, but I would say that not the most common angle, but if you're holding a gun with your thumb on the trigger, not really that difficult at all to do that, right?
It's not. And right. We don't, again, is it would it be unusual? Would it be out of the norm for a situation like this if someone is a self-inflicted wound? Yeah, it doesn't seem to be the norm, but is it possible? 100% possible, based on what we know.
Right. I mean,
we're not the investigators, we're not there, but it seems like it's possible.
The mom's contention is, or her kind of theory of what happened was, he was brushing his teeth at the sink, and he was struck from behind, and that was the blunt force trauma wound injury to the back of the head. And then when he was down on the ground or down kneeling almost or whatever, shot by someone else in the top of the head. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I there could be a bunch of different theories. It's hard to really say, but it does look like those droplets of blood right there by the sink did drop straight down. Now, how do you... What do? You do DNA testing. You just make sure that's all his blood, first of all. And the one thing, Mark, that we haven't talked about is the tuft of what was described as wig hair with a clip on it. And man, try as I might, I see the tuft of hair in the hinge of the right there in the hinge of the door. Right, that I think that's what we're talking about. I don't see a clip, and I don't know if maybe that's more visible from the other side of the door. You know, because of the blood spatter there, you can say that the door was open in that manner when the blood hit it. Otherwise, it wouldn't have gotten deep in that crevice there. Do you see any clip there, or do you just see hair? What do you see in that picture?
And by the way, and you mentioned this earlier, Bill, when we looked at these before we actually start the show today, and your eye is better than mine, because I would not have made that out, at least, you know, from this perspective, that's probably hair, and you're right. But that's all I can see as well. If that is what it is, and I think you're right, is a tuft of hair, but I can't see anything else associated with it. Now, if someone else were to point it out or expand this, maybe it would come to light, but that's all I can see as well.
Yeah, and... You know, if there was there definitely was, it's not if, there was a gunshot wound to the head, you know, very well could be his hair. Now, the mom is making it a point that it's not his hair, but I feel like DNA testing would let us know that, you know, relatively quickly. And that's an important thing to.
We're talking. Going on 2.5 months ago.
Yeah.
And when's the article? I forget the date on the article I read, but it's very recent. And the hair has still not been tested. Now, by the way, you wouldn't even have to test the hair for DNA, I don't think. I think you can probably type things to determine whether or not it's consistent at this point. Mm-hmm. But it just seems like the way things work now, I mean, things are so fast with DNA, unlike 30 years ago. It seems like they could either say this is from the victim or it's not consistent with the victim at this point. I don't know what's taking so long with the DNA on the hair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think the police collected the evidence, right? So my understanding, Mark, was that this was what was left. So these aren't crime scene photos that the police took. And I'm sure they have their own set of photos that are much better than these. These are photos and video that the family took, and they actually took over the lease of the apartment to ensure that they could protect the quote crime scene, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So correct. They're still paying the rent on this apartment and leaving it as is, hoping that the police will come and collect this evidence and analyze it. And I don't know as of today whether that's happened or not happened.
Nor do I.
Right.
So hey, Bill, maybe go ahead.
No.
Well, I may get in front here a little bit, but the other aspect of this is the ballistics testing for the weapon. Uh-huh. And as far as I know, I don't know if the police are interested or if they have or haven't, but we're still waiting for results on the ballistics. And why that's so important to me is, in other words, if this were not self-inflicted, if there was someone else in the apartment, we would know right away if another weapon was used that it wasn't his own weapon. It wasn't his Glock that was used. Or if the ballistics do match the bullet to his personal weapon, then we have to jump to the conclusion that an intruder used his weapon to commit this crime. In other words, either way, it gives us some more, you know, direction and where to go, but we're still waiting on the ballistics as far as I know. Maybe you have more information on that.
No, that's a really excellent point, Mark. Would a contract killer or an assassin show up to an apartment and use the victim's gun to kill him? You know what I mean? Or that doesn't really make sense.
He would have to know the gun is there. That's part of his plan. That's right. Ahead of time.
Right. Right. Where it is, take it out. And, you know, it looks as though it was just loaded, you know, at this point in time. You know, you're talking about a lot of things that would have had to happen there. And to be blunt, that just doesn't make any sense. If a true assassin's coming, he's got his own gun and he's going to be in and out pretty quickly. So, you know, a thing that's interesting, Mark, and it goes to the kind of general condition of the apartment and what may or may not have been going on in Suchir's life is, you know, I guess he used to invite his parents, or his parents would come visit him quite regularly, right? Yes. And then that switched, and he would only go to visit his parents. They were not invited to visit him in his apartment anymore. And he would only go during the week, not on the weekend. And the mother kind of thought that this was somehow related to his security. He didn't feel it was safe to have people visit him. That, to me, you know, with my experience, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Weekends, security on weekends aren't any different than security during the week. If you're hiding from someone threatening you or a potential assassin, doesn't make a difference. But it does go to the mom's assessment of the condition of his apartment and the quote ransacking. You know, was it really ransacked? Or like you said earlier, you know, we need a baseline. No one's been, you know, I don't think the family had visited him here in some time. So they may not know these changes were going on or the state of disarray that the apartment was in, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Again, it's all one's perception. I think, look, there certainly are clear signs that a house, an apartment has been ransacked. If you have dressers and being turned over, drawers pulled out, turned upside down, things like this, bed sheets ripped off, I think, you know, you get to the thresholds like, hey, someone came in here looking mm-hmm. for something. Are we there with these photographs? You know, I don't think so. It's certainly not definitive to me.
No, not with these photographs, at least, unless, like we said, unless there was more that we don't know. One other thing is, and this goes to just, you know, a parent's, hey, a self-inflicted injury like that doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense, and it really shouldn't make sense to the parents. Whatever happened that day, they certainly don't want to believe it was a self-inflicted injury. And we have a clip of the mom here talking about, and Anthony, if you could cue that up, talking about a lawyer she hired and then another lawyer she hired and a crime scene investigator. And I'd like to play that. Let's listen to this, Mark.
the first attorney, he was reluctant to help us. When he said when medical examiner's office said suicide, he didn't want to fight because they have been threatened, obviously. Then we hired a second attorney. He got a crime scene investigator. And our attorney said, we'll give you explanation of every blood mark. And he came back this Monday and he gave explanation. And none of that explanation he gave corroborates to what happened in the apartment based on what we see. That means even the crime scene investigator was bought. He gave inaccurate results. Both the attorneys...
So this is what kind of, you know, I question here, right? Because she talks about the first attorney they hired was reluctant to help because it was ruled a suicide. And he just said, I'm not going to fight this one. You know, however that went down, I don't know. They hire a second attorney who hires a crime scene analyst. Now, I don't think she is a crime scene analyst. I don't think the husband's a crime scene analyst. They are people that want justice for their son. I completely understand that and credit them for fighting for this up to this point. But a crime scene analyst did look at this and provided an explanation of, according to what she said, every blood drop, right? Now, she said that analysis didn't make sense for what she saw in the apartment and that he was bought. He was bought off. Mark, talk about just in general, right? These conspiracy theories that require everybody to be bought off, to be paid off, to be in cahoots together. We're talking about the police, the coroner, now an independent attorney that she hired and a crime scene analyst that she's now saying has been bought off. You know, what's the likelihood of this actually happening?
Very low.
Yeah.
And it, Bill, you made the point so well about, you know, a parent losing a child and it just, none of us want to put ourselves in this position's mentality. It's just, you know, mentally, it's just too hard to deal with. So our hearts go out to her and her family, her husband. But sometimes it's just, you know, things don't add up in the sense that maybe she wants them to. So yeah, the second attorney's bought off, you know, by whom, why, and how do they get to the attorney? And that, like I said, goes back to the initial responding police officers, then the detectives, the coroner's office, the medical examiner who said this is self-inflicted, and Bill, then we get to the point where she had a second autopsy, and guess what? That doctor said the same thing. Self-inflicted.
Oh, did he?
Yes. Yeah, I think I have the article pulled up. I hope I'm not misquoting, but I will look for it while we're talking.
Yeah, could you? Because I thought the autopsy they commissioned, he did not agree that it was self-inflicted.
Yeah, I'll look for that. And again, I want to make sure I'm not misquoting this. And I have a lot of articles open, and I'll see if I can find it. Or Anthony or Vince, if you happen to be able to find that as well. But in other words, to weave this level of conspiracy from so many different individuals, professions, it's difficult. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah. The lawsuit by Balaji's parents offered clues about the results of a separate autopsy, which they commissioned in December. That examination found Balaji died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound that had a trajectory that was atypical and uncommon.
Well, yeah, you found it. That's probably what I...
However, the lawsuit provided no details of that autopsy's final findings of the matter. Yeah.
Yeah. It was an unusual trajectory, but the second autopsy said it was self-inflicted.
Yeah, and now, Anthony, can you, or Vince, can you look for, on YouTube, somebody put a comment in one of the short videos we did on this, and I could maybe find it on my phone, and you know, it's a little bit, it's not the most polite comment, let me put it that way. But it does bring up something that we should probably talk about before we wrap up. I'm trying to get YouTube open on my phone here. And let's see now. Give me a minute. That is like, how much of a big deal is this lawsuit? Is this a lawsuit that was worth killing someone over? And, you know, this is really, you know, not something that the parents want to hear. And, you know, I'm just going to read this comment for what it is. It says, he's just unfortunate. I can't imagine it's a murder. He just doesn't seem that important. And obviously, you know, every life mark is important. We're not trying to minimize the importance of his life. I think the proper way to term that would be probably, or perhaps what this person was trying to get at is, how important is this lawsuit? Like, it's mm-hmm. copyright. It's a copyright lawsuit. It's really not that big a deal that he would have had anything, I think, incredibly groundbreaking. Now, let me say this. This is a quote, and I got this from an interview that his mom did with Tucker Carlson. This is about a lot, and this was the question that was asked, is, hey, this is a copyright lawsuit. Like, mm-hmm. is that, you know, that's not really something that generally you would see a murder over. And here's the quote. This is about a lot of other things that are going on that could cause harm to society potentially, right? That's what she said, but she could not provide or would not provide any details about what those things were or who told her those things or anything else. There's a GoFundMe that's been established. I don't know, you know, how much money that's raised right now, but I think, Mark, probably the way to wrap it up is to talk about, from an investigative standpoint, what could be done to kind of put this thing to bed. No one heard a gunshot, or no one reported hearing a gunshot, which is pretty unusual in an apartment setting. You agree with that, Mark?
Well, it's unusual in unless there was nobody home. In other words, I'm not sure what do you recall what time of day it was?
It would have been 10 or 11 at night.
Oh, well, people should be at home generally, yeah. Plus everybody works graveyards there. But yeah, I would say it's unusual. I would say that's unusual that no one heard a gunshot. But here's the thing, Bill. There was a gunshot.
Yep.
So we know what happened. Why the other three or four neighbors, you know, in close vicinity didn't hear it's an interesting question, but we know what happened and somehow it wasn't heard. So I don't have an answer to that, but it in other words, it doesn't define anything to me.
What I think, you know, if we were investigators or if I was an investigator on this case, I'd be, and I'm, you know, hopefully the police did this or have done this or are doing this. Talk to the neighbors, and did he have regular visitors at the apartment, and what they heard that night or what was going on that night, if they heard anything, and what regular, was there any regular visitors that they can say used to come over and visit him? Interviews of friends from his vacation trip. I think that was done. At least I know the family's done it. I don't know if police have done it. Very simple one was like signs of forced entry on the front door.
Yeah.
You know, did someone break into the apartment, or did he, you know, is the theory that he let someone in, it was someone he knew, or like what exactly was it? And then we talked about hair analysis or DNA analysis. Mm-hmm. I think that would put a lot of this to bed. I mean, here's what it comes down to. You know, the family is holding on to this fact that he was a whistleblower, and that her son would have been a great humanitarian, would have started an indirect competitor to OpenAI, would have made a difference in the world, and that he's a martyr. And I get that. That could be the case either way. You know what I mean? I mean, that could really be the case no matter how he died. He did great things. He was part of something great. But I don't think that's really points too much of I don't think that lens over the crime really leads us to find out exactly what happened and why it happened. And I think whenever there's a self-inflicted injury, the circumstances around it, you're never going to make sense of it.
Rarely. There's always going to be some loose end.
Right.
And this is the case. I mean, look, a good investigation not only determines what happened to some level of certainty, but it also excludes other possibilities. And now, were there things done wrong in this investigation? Quite possibly, maybe even probably, but to our knowledge, have they excluded other possibilities? I mean, I think reasonably, and there's just nothing else to lead to an assault here. Mm-hmm. In other words, there was another party involved here at this point. Maybe there was, maybe something will come forward in the future. But right now, Bill, you know, that's where my mind is that with all the unanswered questions, and there are a few, with the blood here and there and how it happened, did he die instantly? In other words, it just seems like this was what it appears to be.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mark. I want to hear what people think. I know we tried to cover the big points of evidence that the family has brought up, the big points of evidence that we have pictures and video of. There's a lot of things we don't have pictures and video of. Let us know what you think. Is there something that we missed? Is there a piece out there that causes you to lean dramatically one way or the other? Or, you know, what happens next, I guess. Thanks for joining us on this one, the story of Suchir Balaji. I don't know that there'll ever be the type of definitive answer that satisfies the family, but I think based on the evidence, we have a pretty good idea of what likely happened at this point. Thanks for tuning in, folks.